This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Haphazard communication from politicians, distrust in the news media, and an ever-toxic online ecosystem have created a contagion of their own, one the World Health Organization has called the infodemic here and abroad. Because coronavirus can't just be a natural pathogen doing what viruses do. There must be something else, something evil or nefarious or greedy, but definitely human behind it, like Wi-Fi.
But what 5G actually does, it absorbs oxygen.
The idea being pushed by some is that the pandemic is caused not by a virus, but by radiation from 5G towers, amplified online by celebrities like Woody Harrelson, John Cusack, and musician M.I.A.
5G burning, 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 burning.
After watching the conspiracy theory spread throughout Western Europe and Canada, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security began urging telecoms this week to prepare for attacks on cell towers in the United States. And beyond the transmission of infectious foreign rumor, we have our own homegrown paranoia to contend with. According to a Pew survey, nearly a third of Americans believe that COVID-19 was originally developed in a lab, a claim that runs counter to the current overwhelming scientific consensus. And then there's that theory's cousin that the virus escaped from a lab in Wuhan. Here's Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz telling Tucker Carlson on Fox how the U.S. subsidized Chinese incompetence or worse.
The NIH gives this $3.7 million grant to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. They then advertise that they need coronavirus researchers. Following that, coronavirus erupts in Wuhan.
What followed, as 60 Minutes recently observed, was a disturbing escalation by the president.
The Obama administration gave them a grant of $3.7 million. I've been hearing about that.
Not long after, his administration suspended the NIH grant. Never mind that Trump renewed and increased the same grant last year. Never mind that the money actually went to an American NGO that collaborated with Chinese scientists. Never mind that the money was used to develop a promising drug that is being used in the United States to treat COVID-19 patients. Once a conspiracy theory gets going, it's nearly impossible to contain. Which is why disinformation watchdogs are reeling after a 26-minute video excerpt purporting to be a preview from an anti-vax documentary called Plandemic went super viral earlier this month. Kelly Weil is a reporter with The Daily Beast. She's used to seeing paranoiac content mostly siloed in fringe online spaces, but Plandemic surged into the mainstream, feasting on the fear, suspicion, and uncertainty surrounding COVID-19 in an unusually slick package.
It looks like something you might watch on Netflix. It has a lot of the panache of a highly produced, reputable film, which makes it stand out from what we would typically consider a crank conspiracy video, you know, terrible photoshops and muffled voice speaking over them.
The video clip that we've seen so far, I guess it's, you know, something like a quarter of the larger documentary film that's presumably on its way, is based on an extended interview with a discredited researcher named Judy Mikovits.
Dr. Judy Mikovits has been called one of the most accomplished scientists of her generation. Her 1991 doctoral thesis revolutionized the treatment of HIV/AIDS. At the height of her career, Dr. Mikovits published a blockbuster article in the journal Science.
She is a virologist, I gather, who has a long history with vaccines, but a very checkered history. And by the way, she spent some time in jail. Who is this woman?
Judy Mikovits is a former researcher who used to do a lot of work on chronic fatigue syndrome. Unfortunately, her biggest triumph, which was a breakthrough, she thought, about why people have chronic fatigue, turned out to be the result of a contaminated lab culture. In other words, she discovered nothing and her biggest journal article was retracted. So she's had an infamous claim to fame. And since her fall from grace, she's really spent a lot of time circling alt health organizations. She has been on the fringes of the anti-vaccination movement. And over the past 2 years or so, she's really spent a lot of time blaming Dr. Fauci for her downfall.
The man who is heading the pandemic task force was involved in a cover-up.
He directed the cover-up. And in fact, everybody else was paid off, and paid off big time. Millions of dollars in funding from Tony Fauci, Tony Fauci's organization, National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease. These investigators that committed the fraud continue to this day to be paid big time by the NIAID.
She has claimed that he attempted to suppress her work, which we now know was removed from a journal because it was found to be inaccurate. Dr. Fauci has denied that he ever said anything like that. He doesn't appear to have actually interacted with her much, but nevertheless, she's made him out to be the sort of scapegoat for her career ills.
Can you tell me about what got this video clip deplatformed from the main social media outlets?
Well, large social media outlets like Facebook eventually removed the clip because they said it could cause imminent harm. And the reason I think they cited that was because she claimed that not only are face masks not helpful, they are helpful. She claimed that wearing a face mask activates the virus.
Wearing the mask literally activates your own virus. You're getting sick from your own reactivated coronavirus expressions. And if it happens to be SARS-CoV-2, then you've got a big problem.
Now, that doesn't mean anything at all. If somebody watches Plandemic and they believe everything she's saying in there, then they're very likely not to wear a mask and, in fact, to encourage people around them to skip wearing masks. And as we know, that can really cause a detrimental effect to everyone in your surroundings.
There's a lot going on in Plandemic, but if you had to boil it down, what would you say is the main gist of the video?
The main gist is one that we see in a lot of anti-vaccination and alt-medicine and general conspiratorial circles, which accuses public health officials and medical researchers of having nefarious purposes. She seems to imply that Dr. Fauci and others in his circle are profiting from this illness.
If we activate mandatory vaccines globally, I imagine these people stand to make hundreds of billions of dollars that own the vaccines.
And they'll kill millions, as they already have with their vaccines.
A lot of conspiracy theorists want to undermine public trust in the health apparatus because they believe that they are being coerced into doing things that we know are for the good of the public health. So things like taking vaccinations, which aren't just for you, they're for everybody around you. It builds herd immunity. And a lot of them, like Dr. Mikovic, are promoting their own books and videos for profit. So there's a very direct gain for someone like this to be had.
Mikovic's book was trending number one on Amazon's bestseller list. One of the things that makes this video, I guess, effective is that Mikovic is portrayed as a victim, someone who has been silenced by the man, a martyr to truth-telling, which I guess is a recurring theme in the conspiracy genre.
People who believe conspiracy theories believe that they are being acted on very maliciously by an outside group. So there's this built-in martyr persecution complex. So when someone like Dr. Mikovic says that I'm being silenced, I have the truth that they don't want you to know. They are acting against me, and if you listen to me, they're going to act against you. That attracts a lot of people who are already receptive to that sort of message. So although some of us might look at that and say, yes, there's a reason why we don't want you spreading dangerous disinformation, other folks will hear that and say, oh, there's a reason they want her silence. I think that's a very powerful effect.
The more that the social media platforms take down the video, the more juice it has among its potential audience. They're boasting of how great it is that Facebook and Google are playing to the stereotype of powerful institutions.
taking a video down, I think, broadly does help stem the overall flow of it. But when people believe they're being acted against and they try and share the video and the little Facebook pop-up comes up and says, you can't share this video, it's disinformation, they go from viewing themselves as part of, you know, an abstractly persecuted against movement to really feeling as though Facebook is acting against them as a person.
This is Anna Wood, who was a hashtag resistance influencer turned QAnon influencer, who thinks that what they call censorship of Plandemic is absolutely helping their cause.
And the fact is, you can delete as many YouTube videos as you want, as many posts as you want, as many accounts as you want. You can delete this video if you want, but people are still going to see it. And you can't erase their memory. And they're still going to share it with people, even if it's verbally. And the truth is spreading like this. This is the truth movement. People are waking up in the largest numbers you can imagine every single day.
If someone feels like they are being lied to about the coronavirus, and a lot of people do feel like they're not getting all of the right information, then they are more susceptible after watching a video like that to say, well, what else am I being lied to about?
Now, I know this isn't data exactly. It's strictly anecdotal. But you spoke to a woman who had been sort of mildly into conspiracy talk, but once the COVID-19 disinformation started coming out, you know, her antenna went up and, you know, next thing you know, she's looking deeply into QAnon. Who is this lady?
So this is one of a couple women I spoke to who had a similar experience where she was already interested in anti-vaccination. She described herself as a researcher, which some conspiracy theorists do. But she was not into QAnon. She said she hadn't even heard of it. But when she started looking into coronavirus conspiracies, she very quickly found her way to QAnon and almost, I think, immediately made the conversion. QAnon is this deranged pro-Trump conspiracy theory. The main tenet of it claims that most of Trump's enemies are part of a satanic pedophilia and cannibalism ring, and that Trump, what seemed like his public gaffes, are actually part of an elaborate ploy to arrest and send all his enemies to Guantanamo Bay. That's not true, but it nevertheless has, I would say, millions of followers, is my estimation. Now, what videos like Plandemic can do is they are small pieces of a broader conspiratorial network that QAnon is very prominent in. So even if someone is not necessarily interested in QAnon, they're not the type of person to go and seek that out, if they watch a video like Plandemic, it resonates with them, it speaks to the fears that they maybe very reasonably have about COVID, and they go looking for more information from the same channels that they watched this on.
We do know that part of the population, numbering in the millions, buys this stuff. They get caught up in the conspiracy theories for reasons that have been widely speculated about on a political and sociological and psychological level. But how dangerous is it when something like Plandemic comes along? What are the stakes here?
The stakes are that people stop following public health guidelines that are really meant for the public health. You can't be healthy just as an individual. You're as healthy as your community, your family, everyone around you. That's why we wear masks. That's why we get vaccinations, is because it's part of a group protection. There's a great piece in the New York Times about what happens if a vaccine comes out and half the country doesn't want it. And the answer is it doesn't really work. When we have this kind of health disinformation, it's really an attack on our physical health.
Kelly, thank you very, very much.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Kelly Weil is a reporter with The Daily Beast. It's easy to write off conspiracy theories as crackpot fantasies, until a loved one posts a link to some COVID-19 disinformation. Then you have a situation not entirely unlike a cousin struggling with drugs. What do you do? Joe Pinsker, who writes about families and relationships for The Atlantic, wondered just that. And the result is his piece, If Someone Shares the Plandemic Video, How Should You Respond? With help from a psychologist, public health academic, and conspiracy theory expert, Pinsker developed some loose guidelines for that undesirable conversation. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
What's step one?
Step one is kind of a preliminary step. You want to try to assess how strongly somebody believes in something. There are a couple different possibilities here. One actually leads us to the shortest and easiest branch of this decision tree, which is that if the other person is really firm in their beliefs, whether that's something you concluded based on past experience with them or just because of how they're presenting the video now, if that's the case, you probably don't stand much of a chance in getting them to change their minds. And the best option might actually be just to disengage or ignore. The other possibilities, though, are that they're maybe kind of vaguely committed to the video they're sending you. Maybe they're curious about it and express some uncertainty, or that's where you can maybe make some headway. And really, I would say there's an emphasis on the word maybe. The researchers that I consulted on this generally weren't very, very optimistic about your odds here. You should be prepared for what I'm about to describe to not work.
Okay, so let's just say that Aunt Linda shares this video on Facebook. And you know Aunt Linda, she's always worrying and she may be a little bit gullible, let's say. But, you know, not a diehard Alex Jones fan. So she's a little intrigued and a little just freaked out. Because look, if Plandemic were true, that would be scary. So you see Aunt Linda's post and what do you do next?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's a bit eerie that you actually picked the name of a specific relation I have. And I just have to say, for the sake of Aunt Linda's good name, that she is not subscribing to this.
Okay, well, let's just say Aunt Dorothy.
So yeah, what you'd want to do first is you want to kind of try to think about why they might be drawn to something like this. Maybe underneath everything, it's actually confusion or fear that's motivating them. So along those lines, maybe something you'd say is, I'm glad you brought this up. This documentary is making some scary claims. Or something like, I've heard other people bring this up, and yeah, there really is so much information out there that it can be hard to know what's accurate and what isn't these days. Even if those statements to some extent underplay your own skepticism, I'd think of them as a way of opening up with a bit of diplomacy. They're sort of kind things you could say in service of, in a few moments, getting them to try to give some legitimate piece of media a fair shot. I'd also note one way you're likely to not achieve your goal here, you really don't want to lecture people. You don't want to lose your temper. Those things may feel cathartic to you, but they're probably not going to get you very far in changing minds.
Now, in this case, you know, there's just a high risk not only of offending people, insulting them with your arrogance. You know, even if you try to soft pedal it, it's kind of hard not to sound condescending.
Yeah, one tactic a researcher that I talked to suggested was gently asking somebody about the source that something comes from. Maybe you'd get somewhere if they have to glance at a URL and tell you that they got something from patrioticnewsbomb.com.
All right. There's another tactic that you encountered. This essentially, well, I'll see you your patrioticnewsbomb.com and I'll raise you by the New England Journal of Medicine. Who told you that? And tell me more.
So this was advice from psychologist Joshua Coleman. He talked about, once you've set that opening, empathetic, diplomatic tone, that's when you can kind of pivot to the request that you're going to make. I think the step before that is you kind of gently introduce your skepticism and say, those are some scary claims in that video. I'm pretty skeptical, though, because the stuff in the video doesn't match up with what I've been reading. And then that's when you segue into what you'd actually like them to do. So you could basically just say, like, you know, would you mind if I sent you an article about that? And I would even also add that you could throw in another diplomatic gesture there to further try to convince them, which is something like, you know, it might be good for both of us to consider the various sources that are out there.
This seems like you have to venture into deceit with Aunt Dorothy along the lines of, well, you know, we both have to keep an open mind in order to, you know, sort of trick her into looking at a credible source.
I totally get this objection. You know, you could also try to say something that's a bit closer to it, the truth. Say, like, I think it'd be good for us to be aware of everything that's out there. But really, the goal here is anything that sets a tone of compassion. And I think it's possible to do that without compromising any of your own integrity or granting the video some legitimacy that it doesn't actually have.
Now, there's another technique that I think of as sort of the halfway house to reality that was suggested by a Harvard public health researcher named Rachel Pilch Loeb to redirect your aunt's attention to someplace that might be not your go-to for public health information, but you know she trusts more than CNN and the New York Times.
Rachel Pilch Loeb studies risk communication, and she was saying that maybe something you do is to try to think through what sort of outlets the person you're talking to might already be familiar with, something that they already trust, and send them something from there. Maybe you could send them a social media post from some celebrity that you know they like. Really, you can kind of use what you know about them and what they like to pick something out that they might trust more.
I have to ask you this. Some listeners may say that, you know, being empathetic with people who are spreading dangerous conspiracy theories, even naively, is, to start with, a waste of time because you're just not going to dislodge their suspicion and superstition. Why be empathetic with someone who is actually a vector for dangerous lies? You know, what about tough love?
I'm not necessarily saying that this is what's best if, for instance, you're a newspaper that's publishing a piece fact-checking some politician's speech, or, you know, the best way to call out disinformation when you're tweeting to 10,000 people. In those situations, it may well be the case that, you know, a more forceful approach is in order. But here, really, what we're trying to optimize for is two things. One is the sort of the harmony of your relationship with somebody, and the other is the possibility that they'll change their minds. And what I heard when I talked to these researchers was that, you know, forcefully pushing back on this, especially in a way that they find threatening, probably won't get you very far in either respect. So what I've described, it may not work every time, and it may take a lot of effort and restraint, and there may be so many other places we could channel our empathy, but it's one way you might hack away at a messy problem that we're all left to deal with on an individual level. I'd also note that this strategy isn't something that I personally think you have to do, that we're obligated to do. I mean, if you don't have the emotional bandwidth to engage with people who believe in conspiracy theories, that's fine. But I do think a lot of people want to try because these are friends and family members we're talking about. And if you want to try, this seems to me like how you'd make the most progress.
Now, one last thing, Joe. You know, I've been kind of jokey with you about this whole thing and maybe condescending in exactly the way that you're advising we avoid. This is not really a trivial matter. And when we're talking about relationships with people we care about, attention must be paid and care must be taken. The stakes are not low.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think this is something that is really, really difficult for people to try to navigate. I guess one way I'd think about it is if everything that we've talked about sounds like going out of your way and making a really deliberate effort, that's because it is. I think that's going to be what it takes to undo some of the damage that this particular conspiracy theory has done to your relationship with someone you care about. I mean, I guess one thing that struck me after talking with these experts is that even if these conversations don't go in the way that you hoped, if somebody ends up feeling attacked or totally closing the door on you, that at least can help prompt you to get into a different mindset. That's where you phase out of being a fact checker and phase back into whatever relationship you have with somebody. And then I think you start figuring out what that relationship looks like to you, working around the fact that you just aren't going to change their mind on this.
Joe, thank you so much.
Thanks very much for having me.
Joe Pinsker is a staff writer for The Atlantic, where he writes about families and relationships. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, Zandra Ellen, and Eloise Blondio. Our engineers this week were Sam Baer and Josh Hahn. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.